time once again for Community Forum. And we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Randy Horton. Randy Horton is an assistant professor at Seattle University, where he teaches courses on the psychology of political violence and trauma. His specialization is in clinical psychology, with a focus on refugee and immigrant mental health issues. As a Fulbright and Woodrow Wilson Foundation Fellow, he has done research on the lives of Tibetan refugees, looking at the psychology of anger and conflict in Tibetan communities in India and Nepal. And he was a speaker on the panel Health Professionals and Torture, Perpetrators, Activists, and Healers at this year's War and Global Health Conference held at the University of Washington. Randy, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're more than welcome.
Start out, talk about, I want to continue on the same subject that you had spoken of at the panel discussion at the War and Global Health Conference about torture and health professionals and the role of psychologists in all this. So maybe you could start out with the field of psychology and how this kind of came to be.
Sure. A good place to start might be to kind of clear up some what I think of as just kind of popular misconceptions that people may have about the field of psychology. And kind of there's a view that's out there and prevalent that psychologists are by and large typically involved in kind of mental health issues and healing and promoting human well-being and such things. And to some degree, that's true, and that does reflect the activities of a great number of people in the field of psychology. But there's a kind of different history there as well, and the field breaks up in a lot of different ways. And even from its very beginning, when psychology was kind of like finding its foundation and identity in the late 19th, early 20th century, we had psychologists involved in a number of different types of activities that kind of cut against the grain of this. One of the kind of first kind of standout moments in the field of psychology was in the early 20th century, as the first intelligence tests were developed in France by Alfred Binet. They were brought over to the United States by a psychologist who was working with handicapped adults and individuals, his name was Henry Goddard, and he translated these tests into English for the first time, and suddenly kind of became a convert to the movement of kind of intelligence testing and psychological testing and really worked to kind of promote the use of intelligence tests on the part of a number of individuals who had become deeply involved in like the racial eugenics movement, for instance. So psychologists were kind of there at an early moment, in a different type of role from this healing role. And psychologists like Goddard authored studies that were taken up, for instance, in Nazi Germany and used in the training of physicians and medical professionals in Nazi Germany. In essence, kind of like using the new technologies and techniques of this new science of psychology to sort among human beings and in the hands of kind of like Nazi medicine and Nazi government to make decisions about, you know, literally who should live and die, who should be allowed to breed and reproduce and have children. In the field of psychology, it kind of moves on from there, and psychologists kind of gained credibility and a great deal of kind of like resource and attention around World War I when the United States government and armed forces kind of realized the potential value of using things like intelligence tests to sort among the millions of recruits that were coming into military service to kind of decide who would be capable of what types of roles and jobs and things. Psychologists were there kind of making a case that their new science, their new technologies could kind of further and foster the aims of this. So it kind of right throughout the history of the field and kind of like up to the present day, psychologists have been, you know, kind of deeply involved and engaged in a lot of different activities. And some of that research has been, kind of used and made accessible to government, to the armed forces in different ways, some of it, you know, kind of very beneficial, and no one would have any problem or argument with it, but some in much more questionable ways.
So how did we get to the point where psychologists and the American Psychological Association got involved with the U.S. torture program?
Well, that really kind of moves through a couple of phases, and probably... we could talk about kind of like psychologists' involvement in kind of Cold War, in support of Cold War intelligence aspirations and aims, and consulting to the CIA and intelligence community with regard to developing interrogation techniques. I mean, psychologists were there, and their research was being mobilized and being used during this time period. But the modern era of psychological involvement in human rights abuses, and I would say, frankly, torture, really begins around the time of September 11. And under the auspices of a program that had been established at the end of the Korean War. This was the SERE program, S-E-R-E, standing for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. This was a program that had been established towards the end of the Korean War, across different branches of the military. And the idea of the program was to take military personnel from the different branches who might be in danger of being captured, and specifically might be in danger of kind of becoming captured by regimes that we wouldn't expect to observe the Geneva Convention. And the idea of this program would be that we would, you know, kind of put pilots from different branches, maybe Rangers, Special Service, Special Forces personnel, through a kind of inoculation program where they would be subjected for a number of days to the kinds of conditions that they might meet if they were captured by, you know, by these kind of like a enemy Cold War regimes, was how it was originally done. So as a part of kind of like simulating and training our personnel, psychologists were involved in a role of kind of like developing and kind of mimicking the types of interrogation techniques that you might have seen used by North Korea and by the Soviet Union at the time. These were techniques that included a range of kind of like what have come to be called like no touch torture techniques, with sleep deprivation, stress positions, sexual humiliation, exposure to heat and cold, but also some techniques that were very physical and visceral, that involved beatings, waterboardings, and things like this. So psychologists were there kind of running these programs, and there with, you know, with members of our armed forces kind of like overseeing this, and they were both in the role of kind of like designing what would be happening, what types of experiences GIs would be subject to, but also saying and making evaluations when, you know, when soldiers had enough, when they should be kind of like withdrawn from the, you know, from this type of training if they were overwhelmed. So this program was in place and had a lot of, psychologists, military psychologists kind of like staffing it. And what happened was that after 9/11, two psychologists who had been involved in the SEER programs for a number of years, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, came forward, and they were already kind of in communication with the American intelligence communities at this time, and they were kind of developing a consulting role towards the intelligence communities. They came forward and they offered that in the wake of 9/11, these techniques that they were using at these schools could be kind of reverse engineered and applied towards detainees and prisoners who were being picked up or kind of like acquired and brought in from the battlefield or other locations. So in effect, you know, the things that they had been doing in these kind of mock-up interrogations with U.S. GIs could be used on real detainees. And the assumption was that they would be effective in doing these things.
So they developed a program around that.
Yes, they did. They kind of shopped the proposal at first to members of the CIA and intelligence community. And they kind of dressed it up with, it sounds like from the accounts that I've been able to kind of collect, dressed it up with scientific language and, you know, kind of made it sound like they had a kind of like science of interrogation and a science of kind of like breaking down psychologically individuals and kind of getting them to kind of like yield up in a posture of entire helplessness, all of their secrets, and kind of like give us all the goods on anyone who we could kind of gain custody of.
All right. And so this program was used at U.S. facilities?
The way that it happened was the program was proposed and it was adopted, and it seems like it was vetted at kind of like high levels by members of the Bush administration, the Department of Defense, and their Office of Legal Counsel. And it received its first trial in March and April of 2002 when Abu Zubaydah was apprehended in Afghanistan. There's a number of different accounts of kind of like the way the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah proceeded. He was thought at the time to be, it was stated, the third most important member of Al-Qaeda. That turned out not, in fact, to be the case. But The FBI was initially put in charge of the interrogation, and they used traditional rapport building techniques and non-coercive interrogation techniques with him. And he yielded up some useful information right away. That's kind of like not in dispute. But the CIA teams with Mitchell and one of these psychologists kind of like in tow with their new kind of regimen of interrogation based on these SEER techniques arrived, thereafter in Thailand and took over the interrogation. And this, as far as we know, was the first case of these, you know, kind of enhanced interrogation techniques, as they've euphemistically been described, being used in the war on terror in the modern era. With a psychologist, Mitchell, kind of like at the helm in the background, kind of like offering suggestions. In fact, you know, some of the suggestions that Mitchell had brought forward at the time was, Mitchell apparently wanted to build a coffin and to bury Abu Zubaydah alive, in this coffin. And he proposed this to the interrogation team and they, you know, I think wisely declined to do that, but they certainly didn't decline, and they signed off on and then instigated a host of different kind of really aggressive interrogation techniques that combined most independent judges would say would constitute torture.
Including numerous incidents of waterboarding, is that right?
Yes. Abu Zubaydah, as we now have the information, was waterboarded 83 times. During the course of 1 month and 1 month of interrogation in Thailand.
So that's over twice a day.
Yeah, well over, yeah, on some days quite a bit more than that.
All right. So, and you brought a segment with you that I want to make sure we get to, so.
Yeah, this would probably be a good time to play it. This is a segment that's from an interview that was conducted on NPR's All Things Considered back in May of last year. And in this segment, an NPR journalist is interviewing Bryce LaFever. He's a psychologist who had also worked within the SEER programs. And he's an associate of Mitchell and Jess and these two individuals who were instrumental in kind of like setting up this program. And he's kind of coming forward offering a kind of, an account from the perspective of individuals inside the military sympathetic to these, you know, this reverse engineering and these new techniques. So we can kind of cue that and
all
listen.
Right. This is from NPR's All Things Considered.
LaFever himself had just started work at a SEER program out at the Naval Station in San Diego. Like the other psychologists, he spent his days meeting out physical and psychological abuse. Work, he says, he actually came to love.
The training was fascinating to watch. It's always fascinating to watch people in extreme situations, how they grow, how they learn, how they adapt. It was a human laboratory.
And says LaFever, to the psychologists working in this human laboratory, there was one thing they felt convinced was absolutely and abundantly clear. These techniques worked, even with people with unflinching inner strength.
You know, the tough nut to crack, if you keep him awake for a week, you torture him, you tie his arms behind him, you have him on the ground, anyone can be brought beyond their ability to cope and resist.
And according to LaFever, can be forced to give up information, though it should be pointed out that contention is very much in dispute.
If I could further the cause of America using my skill as a psychologist, I wouldn't hesitate to do it. And that, in a sense, became our marching orders, was to help America and use our skills in any way we possibly can as a psychologist.
Of course, these marching orders took on a whole new color in the wake of September 11th.
America's house was broken into on 9/11, and somebody's got to raise their hand to stop it. And at some point, you do anything you can to stop the assault. And early on, there was a sense of desperation in intelligence gathering.
And so, according to LaFever, it was really only natural for people with this kind of experience to suggest that the techniques be used on detainees. That's the word he used, natural.
Anyone could have made those recommendations. I think that Jim Mitchell, Bruce Chesson were the main players in that, but anyone assigned to those SEER schools would have probably made the same recommendations.
He points to one of the techniques that was approved by the Justice Department lawyers. After discovering that one of the detainees had a morbid fear of bugs, interrogators wanted to lock the man in a small container with an insect.
But if you came to me and you said I had a bug phobia, well, I would prescribe the exact same treatment, which is an exposure treatment. In any phobia, the treatment of choice is exposure. In other words, direct, prolonged exposure to the thing you're afraid of, and you overcome the fear because you calm down in the presence of this thing that triggers your fear. So the things that are called, you know, torture or exploitative are also therapy techniques.
For a civilian psychologist, the only concern is the patient, the person sitting in front of you. But according to Lefevre, this group of military psychologists saw things very differently.
The ethical consideration is always to do the most good for the most people. And America happens to be my client. Americans are who I care about. I have no fondness for the enemy. And I don't feel like I need to take care of their mental health needs.
All right. That was Bryce Lefevre being interviewed on NPR's All Things Considered. And we are here in the studios live with Randy Horton, assistant professor at Seattle University, talking about the role of psychologists in the U.S., current U.S. torture program. A lot of disturbing things there in that segment, Randy.
Yeah, quite a few. It's rich, let's say.
Yeah. One of them that torture and therapy seems to be tight.
Kind of conflated in the minds of Mr. Lefevre. Yeah, that kind of moment and that kind of part of the interview where Lefevre says that, you know, well, if you look at it, you know, if somebody has a phobia, and he's talking about in this case, you know, the discussion is launching from using prisoners' psychological vulnerabilities, kind of medical records and assessment. You know, somebody has a morbid fear of bugs, a morbid fear of heights. Well, you use that as a vulnerability to kind of like attack them, inflict this kind of fear on them and horrify and overwhelm them to kind of gather information or kind of coerce compliance from them. Well, he's suggesting that this is somehow kind of mirrors the therapeutic technique that would be worked with for clinically treating, helping people to overcome phobias, you know, desensitization. You expose them to the thing that they fear and they gradually learn to overcome it. You know, the conflation of this, of the experience of, for instance, like, you know, somebody being interrogated and having a phobia exploited with the work that a psychologist would be doing in helping people kind of like empower and overcome fears and vulnerabilities is, it's an example of something that happens fairly frequently. If you look at the writing and kind of studies of perpetrators and particularly like healthcare professionals when they become involved in human rights abuses and things, one of the most important studies and a really valuable study of kind of like healthcare professionals' complicity, psychologists and psychiatrists' complicity in abuses was a study by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And he talks about in that work the conflation of healing and killing, basically. And we see a kind of parallel going on here. Well, in the Nazi era, many of the doctors who were kind of like instrumental in carrying out essential tasks in the concentration camps, for instance, and sterilization campaigns, and it was medical doctors who stood on the platforms of Auschwitz and made decisions about who would live and who would die. The Nazi Party felt that it should be medical professionals who made those decisions, and they wouldn't allow anybody else to do it. It's very perverse, but if you examine an interview, as Lifton did, individuals who end up in these situations, they'll often kind of show the strange confusion in their thinking about what they're up to at these moments. And you'll see that they're using terminology in terms of like treatment, for instance, in Nazi Germany. You know, a doctor could make a recommendation for treatment, and that would mean literally that somebody who is mentally ill would be a death order for that individual. You know, if you check the box that says treatment, no treatment, you're in luck. You know, you're not going to be kind of shipped off and euthanized. So you kind of see this strange kind of cognitive confusion that occurs sometimes with people in these professions. And I think we're seeing it here. We're hearing it in like Lefevre's work here. It has to do with, I think, you know, kind of some deep moral ambivalences and kind of things that attend to people who get involved in these activities.
So talk about the role and the response of the American Psychological Association, both the leadership versus the members.
Yeah, well, in 2005, some disclosures and information were starting to come forward that suggested that psychologists were kind of active in these roles in supporting interrogations, facilitating interrogations, perhaps like designing and developing you know, these interrogation protocols that amounted to torture in the eyes of many. And the APA's president at the time in 2005 convened a task force on psychological ethics and national security, PENS, the PENS task force. It had 10 members, and it was kind of like handpicked at the highest echelons of the American Psychological Association. And 6 of the 10 members had military ties or conflicts of interest, and 4 of the members of that, by report, I haven't seen the actual, were in the chain of command for, you know, for potential abuses. They were actively, had been in military roles overseeing work at sites where abuses may have been occurring. And Bryce Lefevre served on that task force that was making recommendations to the field of psychology in terms of how its members should ethically conduct themselves. And the conclusions of that task force were that psychologists had a vital role to play in support of national security objectives. And the language of it was such that it kind of tracked closely to, for instance, legal standards and definitions of kind of like ethical conduct the Bush administration had been undermining for a long period of time with their legal opinions. So, you know, the APA has consistently said throughout its modern history that it opposes torture and that psychologists should not be involved in torture. But that whole issue of kind of like what torture gets defined as gets finessed at certain moments. And there was a lot of finessing going on in 2005 with this task force. So as the kind of process kind of became known, and actually one member of that task force, Jean Maria Arrigo, broke ranks with the other members of the task force, and she kind of went public with disclosures about, you know, what she felt was like a inappropriate co-opting of the goals of this task force by members of the task force who had strong ties to the military. So there was a real row within the American Psychological Association. And the net effect was that leadership was unresponsive to any sort of demands for accountability for explicitly kind of like changing and stated policy to make it clear that psychologists should have absolutely no ongoing role in interrogations and abuses. And it came down to it that there seemed to be no other recourse. Individuals who were involved in attempting to kind of like fight the status quo and oppose what was going on in 2008 generated a member-sponsored referendum. They basically got enough signatures from APA members to put out to a vote to the general membership a resolution stating that basically that the APA would forbid psychologists from taking part in any sort of activities on sites that were not in compliance with international law. So any of the black sites, Guantanamo, a number of other types of sites where any types of human rights abuses had been documented or speculated about in a credible way, psychologists should have should not be allowed to be present on these sites unless they were working specifically for detainees on their behalf.
And that was from the membership, and
that was from the membership, and it passed with 59%. 59% of the general membership voted in support of that. I voted in support of that. You know, I was ever so happy when that ballot came around explaining the positions. So it was passed into the bylaws and passed into the standing kind of rules for the APA, but it's largely languished as a kind of dead letter document, and the effort to actually get enforcement and to get APA leadership to take a kind of frankly active posture in, you know, kind of seeking out, trying to find information about where its members are working and things like that, and kind of expressly kind of forbid them or impose professional consequences on them for continuing to work at those sites hasn't taken place.
All right. Only a few minutes left. So documents, information continues to trickle out. Can you give us a sense for recent stuff that's come before you?
Yes. In fact, you know, the broad picture, a kind of new dimension of this, it's really come forward just in the last 12 months or so. And in fact, kind of key disclosures as recently as last week. Would be in terms of like pointing towards psychologists' involvement in violations of what we think of as like research ethics on behalf of kind of support of these programs of interrogation. So it's kind of come to light that there was apparently a fairly extensive program of kind of like research and study of these abusive techniques being used on prisoners. And that it was taking place on a number of different sites. We know that at Guantanamo, there are documents that have come forward that suggest for at least about 13 months, psychologists were kind of like collecting data, monitoring interrogations as they kind of had been for a long period of time. But in 13 months between 2002 and 2003, you know, they were actively kind of like doing things like measuring blood cortisol levels, kind of mobilizing the new techniques of a kind of physiology of kind of like stress and distress to try and determine, you know, what types of techniques, what combinations of kind of sensory deprivation, bombardment, humiliation, you know, environmental stressors, exposure to cold, threats by, you know, using guard dogs, exploitation of fears. What were the ideal kind of like combinations of them? How should they be applied to obtain maximum effect? So psychologists were involved in these in direct contravention of international standards that go back to the Nazi era and the Nuremberg trials and the Nuremberg codes that were set up after World War II to restrict and to govern professional ethics and conduct and scientific research. And the degree to which this has been kind of like undermined, these kind of regimens have been undermined, there's a really strong parallel in terms of the Bush administration actions. There's news just came out last week that Paul Wolfowitz in 2002-2003 produced a document that attempted to give basically legal cover to psychologists and behavioral scientists or medical personnel carrying out this type of research. And in its kind of best Orwellian way, the document was titled Protection of Human Subjects and Adherence to Ethical Standards in Department of Defense-Supported Research. Sounds really good, doesn't it? Well, basically the document kind of like redefines the standards for kind of like a research and consent and things like this and kind of removes the category. They had redefined the political prisoners that are being held in the global war on terror as detainees and not prisoners of war. Well, it kind of states explicitly only prisoners of war are entitled to protections accorded by, you know, these basic human rights covenants governing research, and kind of creates the big loophole and exception that then, you know, they kind of like drive a truck full of researchers and technology and equipment through in the years that come.
We have about a minute left. Do you know if things are getting any better under the new administration?
Things have gotten better, appreciably better. There was a kind of a redefinition of forbidding of many of the techniques of coercive interrogation that was instituted in January of last year by the Obama administration. But there are still ongoing abuses, and the way that the kind of practices and policies were redefined was in terms of the Army field manuals. Guidelines would become the guidelines for interrogation practices. But there's a kind of a wiggle clause in the Army field manual and an appendix that allows for continued use of any number of kind of what would have been on the list of those coercive interrogation practices, specifically allowing like manipulation of environmental conditions, some of the things about, you know, kind of like sensory deprivation, isolation of prisoners, and things like this, that in combination can still constitute an extremely coercive regimen of interrogation. So these are still in place, and these are still being used. And recent disclosures suggest that they're being used in Afghanistan at a base in near Bagram Air Base. And this is kind of like where we stand right now, with the APA still kind of with its head in the sand, not really taking any sort of aggressive action on these issues, and psychologists still continuing to support the kind of process of interrogation in many different ways.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Not enough time to cover this. I want to thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
You're welcome.
We've just been talking with Randy Horton. He is an assistant professor at Seattle University, where he teaches courses on the psychology of political violence and trauma. And related to this subject, I want to let you know about a talk happening tonight at 7:30 p.m. at Town Hall, Seattle, titled Unfinished Business, Ending U.S. Torture Forever. The talk will be given by Presbyterian theologian and activist George Huntzinger, who is co-founder of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture. And again, that's 7:30 tonight, Town Hall, Seattle. I believe the tickets are $5.